Following are comments on William Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, Act I. I will wed thee in another key. Theseus, Duke of Athens, and Hippolyta, the Amazon queen, exchange perspectives on their upcoming wedding. He promises to make amends for his violent conquest of the Amazon women. Act I, Scene I opens with a conversation between Theseus, Duke of Athens, and the Amazon queen, Hippolyta, whom he has conquered and is now set to marry. Theseus's desires seem to outpace the time that nature keeps. He says of the moon's progress, quote unquote, "She lingers my desires like to a stepdame or a dowager, long withering out a young man's revenue." Act I, Scene I, lines 4 through 6. Hippolyta prefers to let nature follow its pace, saying, quote unquote, "The moon, like to a silver bow now bent in heaven, shall behold the night of our solemnities." Act I, Scene I, lines 9 through 11. The archetypal war between the sexes of this Athenian duke and Amazonian queen has given way to a traditional wedding ceremony. Theseus promises Hippolyta that violence and chaos will be transformed to marital and social decorum. He will marry the female warrior, quote unquote, in another key, and all will be done, quote unquote, with pomp, with triumph, and with reveling. Act I, Scene I, lines 18 through 19. The course of true love never did run smooth. Hermia and Lysander wish to marry, but Hermia's father, Aegeus, has chosen another suitor, Demetrius, for his daughter, and calls down a harsh penalty on her if she refuses to marry him. Still in Act I, Scene I, while Theseus and Hippolyta may be getting along now, Lysander will soon insist to Hermia, quote unquote, "The course of true love never did run smooth." Act I, Scene I, line 134. Sure enough, Aegeus comes onto the scene to stir up trouble. Act I, Scene I, lines 22 through 23. Aegeus is Hermia's father, and she has offended him by refusing to accept Demetrius, the suitor he has chosen for her. Now the father begs the duke to uphold the harsh law of Athens, which is that Hermia must either marry Demetrius or choose between being executed or remaining a virgin for the rest of her days. Act I, Scene I, lines 41 through 42. In comedies and romance plays, such absurdly cruel laws tend to lie around just waiting for someone to invoke them. Why? Probably because they allow a playwright to set up universal struggles and oppositions in the starkest manner. Aegeus is the traditional angry old man, or senex iratus, derived from Greek and Roman comedy. As such, he serves as an initially serious obstacle in the path of the lovers Hermia and Lysander. If we want to take a semi-Freudian approach for a moment, Father Aegeus may be jealous of his daughter's affection, so he accuses Lysander of offenses just short of warlock status. Lysander says Aegeus has, quote-unquote, "bewitched the bosom of my child." Act I, Scene I, line 27. He has, quote-unquote, "interchanged love tokens with the young lady." Act I, Scene I, line 29. He has sung facetious or, quote-unquote, "feigning songs of love," and he has given her alluring gifts to steal her fancy away from her father and transfer it to himself. All of this sounds to us like normal courtship, but Aegeus takes it as a series of mortal threats. This old man, this senex iratus, aligns himself with the male symbolic power of absolute interdiction. He envisions a rival order to the one Theseus has staked out, one that allows no room for his daughter Hermia to pursue her own natural desires. Aegeus's interdiction will surely be at least partly responsible for the confusion, chaos, and vexation that reigns at the center of Shakespeare's comic play, once the action moves to the woods beyond Athens. Theseus used force to win his own lover, and even though he now intends to trade this violence for a life with Hippolyta within the civic order, he apparently feels constrained to ratify Aegeus's demand that his daughter should obey him or die. Theseus denies Hermia agency. He denies her any choice in the matter of the great civic institution of marriage. He insists that to her, Aegeus should be, quote-unquote, as a god, and describes her as, quote-unquote, but as a form in wax by him imprinted, to preserve or destroy as he sees fit. Act 1, Scene 1, line 47 and lines 49 through 50. Theseus asks Hermia directly whether she can, quote-unquote, endure the livery of a nun just to escape marriage to a man she doesn't love. Hermia's answer is defiance. She will not submit. Act 1, Scene 1, line 70. As for Lysander, he mocks Aegeus and Theseus' promotion of civic right, so-called, over true love. He does not agree with the practice of forcibly enlisting a couple's erotic energy to satisfy collective, society-building imperatives. He points out to Theseus that Demetrius has himself behaved like a cad toward Nedar's daughter Helena, first encouraging her and then cruelly dropping her for his new and financially promising interest in Hermia. All the same, Theseus stands by Athenian law. Hermia must marry Demetrius or choose between, quote-unquote, death or, ellipsis, a vow of single life. Act 1, Scene 1, line 121. Lysander tries to alleviate Hermia's anxieties with a recitation of the several hindrances and catastrophes that ensure the truth of his maxim, quote-unquote, the course of true love never did run smooth. Act 1, Scene 1, line 134. At the same time, the young man describes the experience of true love in a way that illuminates its transformative power. It is, he says, quote-unquote, brief as the lightning in the collied night, that in a spleen unfolds both heaven and earth, and ere a man hath power to say, behold, the jaws of darkness do devour it up. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 144 through 147. Lysander's plan, as he details it to Hermia, involves taking refuge in the woods not far from Athens, and then traveling to his dowager aunt's home, where Athenian law does not apply. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 156 through 168, inclusive. This plan will take the main couples off to one of Shakespeare's most beloved green worlds, the fairy kingdom of Oberon and Titania. Lysander's condition for the trip, quote-unquote, if thou lovest me, seems to annoy Hermia. Act 1, Scene 1, line 163. Or at least it prompts her to swear, among other things, by, quote-unquote, all the vows that ever men have broke, in number more than ever women spoke, that she will gladly make the journey and marry him, leaving behind the golden city of Athens that she loves. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 175 through 176. Through Athens I am thought as fair as she. Hermia's old friend Helena further complicates matters by tattling Lysander and Hermia's elopement plans to Demetrius. In the latter section of Act 1, Scene 1, Helena enters. She is Hermia's childhood friend and has problems of her own to deal with. She is in love with her former suitor Demetrius, who now cares only for Helena, and presumably her father's wealth. When Lysander tells her of his plan to steal away with Hermia into the forest, Helena decides to reveal this information to Demetrius. A strain of jealousy and competitiveness is evident in Helena's complaint after her friend departs with Lysander. Quote unquote, through Athens I am thought as fair as she. Act 1, Scene 1, line 227. In spite of her disappointment, Helena puts much faith in the power of love, even as she says this profound feeling, involves neither judgment nor clarity of vision. Quote unquote, things base and vile, holding no quantity, love can transpose to form and dignity. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 232 through 233. Perhaps then, it is not quality in the lover that we love, but rather what we ourselves project onto or into the beloved. Love is a thing of fantasy and is scarcely amenable to reason. To what extent, then, can we guide desire so that it guarantees order, social harmony, and decorum? As is the case with most of Shakespeare's comedies, that will be a question to consider as the play goes on. In any event, Helena's determination to tattle on her old friend to Demetrius ensures that two human couples, not one, will join the already feuding Oberon and Titania. Hooray, more fun, or is that vexation in the woods? Audiences love this sort of complication, as Shakespeare well knows. Let me play the lion too. Peter Quince, a carpenter, is to direct a production of Pyramus and Thisbe, which a small troupe of workmen hope to put on for Theseus and Hippolyta's wedding festivities. Bottom the Weaver wants to play all the roles. Act 1, Scene 2 extends the theme of transformation, which was introduced by the first scene's conversation between Theseus and Hippolyta, as well as by Hermia's statement about love's projective power. Several workingmen are determined to compete for the honor of putting on a play in the presence of the Duke and Hippolyta. These mechanicals are men whom we would not ordinarily consider significant in the world of art, but at least indirectly, their discussions give us some of Shakespeare's most notable commentary on his chosen profession. Peter Quince is the director of the most lamentable comedy and most cruel death of Pyramus and Thisbe, a tragic play about star-crossed lovers that is nonetheless also a comedy, according to the title. It doesn't matter to Quince and his fellows how their play is classified. The aim is that it be entertaining and affecting. Bottom the Weaver is chosen to play the hero Pyramus, and he demonstrates his skill in declamatory versifying from some old lines of the character Hercules. Act 1, Scene 2, line 16. The problem is he can't imagine confining himself to just one role, even if it's a starring one. As the roles are handed out, Bottom tries to usurp them all. Quote unquote, let me play Thisbe, he pleads, and quote unquote, let me play the lion too. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 43 and 58. Bottom is a delightful, childlike fellow. Some viewers might call him a narcissist, though that's probably too harsh. He wants to project himself into everything around him, and he seems excited at the prospect of using art to escape from everyday reality. That escape, or at least vicarious adventure, is indeed one of the things that art can provide. Meanwhile, Flute, who will play the female lead Thisbe, worries that he is too near to an adult male to play such a role, while Snug the Joiner is blessed with the exciting role of the lion. He worries that he is, quote-unquote, slow of study, so he will need an advance copy of his lines. Quince assures him that he'll do fine. The lines are, quote-unquote, nothing but roaring. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 56 through 57. Bottom's pitch for usurping the lion's role is hilarious, and it brings up an interesting representational concern. Quote unquote, I will roar that I will do any man's heart good to hear me, he boasts. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 58 through 59. But Peter Quince observes that roaring too wildly would frighten the refined, noble ladies in the audience and cost all the actors their necks. Quote unquote, that would hang us, every mother's son, they all say in unison. Act 1, Scene 2, line 64. This concern for the risks of excessive realism in dramatic representation sounds silly coming from working-class artisans trying to put on a foolish play, But it was, in fact, a serious concern going back even to Greek drama. Audiences' emotional reaction, according to some critics, depended on the playwright's ability to induce them to take what they saw on stage as all but real, or at least very lifelike. Verisimilar is the term of art, spelled V-E-R-I-S-I-M-I-L-A-R. The working men, then, offer a logical extension of such a view when they worry about their lion representation frightening theatergoers out of their real-life wits. The lion's part, no pun intended, goes to Snug after all, and Quince need only give out some sensible instructions for the rehearsal. He provides the actors only with their own lines, as seems to have been the practice in Shakespeare's day too, and requests that they should, quote-unquote, con them by tomorrow night. Act 1, Scene 2, Line 83. They are to meet Quince in the woods about a mile from Athens, there to rehearse by the moon's light. The reason the director gives is that if they rehearse outside of town, they will avoid everyday distractions and nosy competitors. Perhaps aside from the privacy-based concerns, these sound like realistic instructions for actors in Shakespeare's time. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Thursday, July 3rd, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations from A Midsummer Night's Dream, I have relied on the revised Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.